Knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. Only on the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee program.
Tap out of
you. You know, just when you think there's no order anywhere, there's order looking right at you.
Okay.
What do you need here?
Andy just said I need you to prove this. This guy worked here at Starfish for 6 years, but his wife's dead, no kids, no will. I just want to roll his pension back up into the fund and make it easy. Come on, don't make me file with the state.
We file with the state so that one day if somebody looks back at this guy's death, he will see that we did our job.
You're right, we got to cover our asses. I got it, sorry.
No, we do our job and we do right by a guy who worked for us. Lest he die in vain.
What's that order in the universe thing?
Well, yeah, our insurer spent $300,000 on this new model, new field data, new society. Who is the ideal employee? Who dies how and when? And they sent it over to show what a great job they're doing. And you know what it says? It says that people with kids live longer than people with no kids. People with two live longer than people with one. Smoking is bad. Speeding is bad. Deaths in the family are bad. Divorce is bad. It's just kind of nice to see that all that junk is still true.
Hey, yo, what's up? Let's keep it real, son. Count this money, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Hey, yo, put the tails over there in the safe, you know what I'm saying? Because we're spending these taxes.
Cedric Muhammad. Cedric Muhammad.
September 30th, 2009, I want to welcome you to the hottest show in the diaspora, Cedric Muhammad Black Coffee Program, CedricMuhammad.com, BlackElectorate.com, BlackCoffeeChannel.com. First time viewers and listeners, I want to say up front, you all are the most important people in the building. And for the regulars, you know how it is. You know how I be. VIP, B-I-G. Who said that? Let me hit the captain's log real quick. A lot that I want to hit on today. Go run, tell somebody. The Watchman is back. Give you an update on my medical condition. To make a point about business and trade. Money Mayweather. I'm going to take my time today and build on the mainstreaming of Floyd Money Mayweather, in case you missed it. Now, I was not one of this number, but 1 million people purchased that fight on September 19th. This is a sign of something. I'm going to get into the science of marketing and business and exactly how Floyd Mayweather has been crossed over or has had people cross over to him. A lot of science behind that. I want to salute him. Shantytowns, not just in South Africa. You got him here in the hood. Country and rural areas in America. Not just Africa. David Patterson, right? Governor of New York. I want to talk to my New Yorkers. The New Yorkers that listen to this show, how do you all feel about President Obama pressuring the first black governor of New York to not run again, step aside? Is that against Obama, the teachings of Obama? Is this a contradiction or is this just the language of power that he speaks? I want to see who's going to be pro-black militant and who's going to be Democrat first, or maybe some people have another take on it. Cocaine in Peru. Oh man, Britain. And I have a hat on. My beloved friend came back from Europe and she gave me a hat. London, England. I will be wearing that when I put the camera on. Hugo Chavez and Muammar Gaddafi together. How do you feel about that? I've been trying to test the waters and throw out trial balloons for this subject of what is the problem or the hang-up that some socialists, some progressives have with Muammar Gaddafi of Libya. The people that embrace Castro and Hugo Chavez for some reason have a problem embracing Muammar Gaddafi. Why? Anyway, Chavez and Gaddafi holding hands and embracing over the weekend in Venezuela. T.O. handling the media at a higher level. We got the evidence. Mike Vick as well. By the way, anyone see NFL.com or NFL TV Red Zone? I want to give all praise and honor to God for giving the idea, probably to a Caucasian, for NFL Red Zone. I sat and watched every touchdown of every single game on Sunday, thanks to the Red Zone channel. If you saw that, let me know. And Rod Ginyard, Rod from Culver City, California, you have, as a matter of fact, I think I may start the show off with this. Some of you know, last night I tweeted during the program Shark Tank, which I think is hands down the greatest business show, most important program you could watch on the subject of business. Shark Tank. We'll spend an hour on last night's show. So I tweeted. You can follow me, twitter.com/CedricMuhammad. During the program, Entrepreneur 1 and Entrepreneur 4, we'll take a look at them. But Rod from California, one of the greatest who ever did it, listening to this show, one of our Black Coffee commentators, he's the anti-Twitter man. Well, he'll be happy to know that he has some support now. For a while, it was just me and Jigga. Me and Jay-Z were the only ones who were not tweeting. But I think the strongest advocate ever against tweeting has arrived. Mike Leach, Texas Tech, tell us how you feel about this thing.
Texas Tech coach Mike Leach has banned his players from using Twitter after a player noted the coach's tardiness to a team meeting in a tweet on Sunday. You can't do that. A day after the Red Raiders lost by one at Houston. The Lubbock Avalanche Journal reports linebacker Marlon Williams asked on Twitter why he was still in a meeting room and, quote, the head coach can't even be on time. That tweet and Williams' page has been deleted.
The policy is nothing football related outside of football, you know. So, I mean, it's any way you look at it, little Twitter things that relate to football is a violation of team rules. And if somebody plays for us, they don't have a Twitter account. And if I find out they do, well, then action will be taken, and that's all there is to it.
That's gangster.
What is your overall thought of college players using Twitter? Do you like that usually, or?
Are you kidding me? I mean, I thought we covered that. I think Twitter's stupid to begin with, and I think anything that's a distraction is stupid. I think that a guy that plays college football gets more than enough attention, and if they don't get enough attention, I've got GAs and I've got student assistants that'll sit there and listen to them embellish stories and talk and say all their stuff and tell them how great they are all they want. Okay, they don't need Twitter. And so no, if you play for Texas Tech, you don't have Twitter. Yeah, I'm not going to sit around with a bunch of narcissists that want to sit and type stuff about themselves all the time. You know, I mean, you know, we'll put mirrors in some of their lockers if that's necessary, but they don't have to have Twitter.
The head coach of Texas Tech football team, Michael Leach, calling anyone who uses Twitter a narcissist. Now, let me see if I can put the camera on me, because I want to make a point. Hold on, let me show you how to write volume. My 3-volume book series on entrepreneurship is coming out next week. The Entrepreneurial Secret, Starting a Business Without a Bank Loan, Collateral, or Revenue. There it goes. Okay, look up. Volume 3. Now, I talk about the personal struggle And the head coach of Texas Tech has a point. Entrepreneurs can be narcissistic. Look at the word narcissism. I talk about it. Donald Trump was one of the first that I ever saw talk about the neurosis of an entrepreneur, the focus that you get into. Anyway, volume 3 of my book out next week, blackelectorate.com, barnesandnoble.com, amazon.com. I go deep into that and the dilemma that it creates in your personal life. Let me get back to the captain's blog. Captain's log. I want to talk about Brick City. I watched all 5 parts, and I hope you did too. Last week we talked about parts 1 and 2. Oh yeah, my hat says London. London, England. This week we'll talk about parts 3, 4, and 5. I want to really cover the whole gamut. A few points of criticism that I have with Brick City, and I want to explain why I have them, because they may be different than the average person, but a lot to like about Brick City, a lot of benefit I think that can come from it. Maybe not what some people expect though. Get a good look, all my viewers in London. Student Minister Brother Hillary, the believers in London, I see you. Shark Tank. Again, last night, a very important show for a couple of reasons, one of which is that I think the final entrepreneur with the soy dough, he makes a powerful case about how to balance the ideology of community development or the ideology of giving back and helping those who come from where you come from, and without compromising business principles. And this is the dilemma that I have seen among a lot of entrepreneurs. They don't know how to balance the ideology of doing for self with the need to practice the science of business. So this entrepreneur at the end, he's a student, I think, at Purdue University. He epitomizes, from what I can tell, what you will need to do to balance that. Let me get to the audio. Governor David Paterson of New York on Meet the Press. What do you think of President Obama's reported, and it seems to be confirmed, reported indication that he does not want Governor Paterson to run? He is the first black governor of New York, and the first black president appears to be dissuading him, discouraging him from pursuing re-election. What do you think about that? Can you give me a non-ideological answer, please?
We are back, and joining us now in an exclusive interview, the Democratic Governor of New York, David Paterson. Governor, welcome.
Good morning,
Dave. It has been quite a week. If you go back to March of 2008, you were appointed governor after Elliot Spitzer's problem. New York's first African-American governor, the first legally blind governor. And now, almost a year and a half later, the headline in the New York Times last Sunday, and here it is, it says, Obama requests that Paterson drop campaign, meaning the campaign for 2010. What happened?
Well, David, first, before I begin, I spoke to Carolyn Maloney, one of New York's senior congressional members who lost her husband this weekend. And I know right after this you're going to do a tribute to Big Russ from Buffalo, also from New York, and I'll leave that to you, but just want to give condolences to all of the families. Right. I've had confidential conversations with the White House, and I'm not going to reveal what those conversations were, other than to tell you that the president has never told me not to run for governor.
Has it been made clear by the president or others working for him that they would like you not to seek re-election?
I mean, I've had conversations with them, but I don't. I think that the people of the state of New York are the ones who should choose their governor.
All right, but let's be very clear here about what happened. The president's team and others speaking on their behalf said to you, you should not run. Isn't that right?
I can't say that, David. There are people who have told me not to run. There are a lot of people who have told me not to run.
But the White House specifically said, don't run.
I don't know that.
You don't know that? You only know you don't have their support.
Well, David, the White House has a country to run, and I have a state to run. And there's politics that go on all the time. I'm blind, but I'm not oblivious. I realize that there are people who don't want me to run. I've never gotten an explicit indication authorized from the White House that I shouldn't run. But what I would say is what I think I should be doing is managing the affairs of my state, and when I run, making my case to the people and letting them decide who the next governor
should be. But fair enough. But I just want to be clear on this point. They certainly sent the message, did they not, that you would not have their support if you ran, and they have concerns about you running, and that you should not run.
They certainly sent the message that they have concerns, and I appreciate that. But let me just tell you at the outset, I am running for governor in 2010. I don't think that this is an issue other than for the people of the state of New York to decide.
So you agree with that poll that found 62% of New Yorkers believe that the Obama administration was wrong to intervene?
Well, what I agree with is that the overwhelming number of people in the poll would like to make that decision for themselves. I'll be running, and I, like other governors, want to make the case for why we've had to make the difficult decisions that we have made.
Let me ask about your reaction, because it was your wife who told the New York Post on Wednesday that you were stunned after these conversations at the White House. Michelle Patterson said her husband was shocked at the request, quoting her, "I think he was stunned. Like I said, this was very unusual." What stunned you?
Michelle was very protective of me. I don't know that I was stunned. I am not. Failing to stand up for my party. I fight for the priorities of my party. I am fighting for the people of the state of New York, who are having a very difficult time right now. I dare say a lot more difficult than I am. So I'm not going to run away from a fight when I know who I'm fighting for. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you, David, that I haven't had a difficult week. But I, like a lot of New Yorkers and a lot of Americans, are having difficult weeks because we're having to make tough decisions. And the tough decisions that I've made were that I've had to reduce spending by $30 billion in 18 months as governor.
And I want to get to that in just a minute, but I want to be clear. If the White House wants you out, you are undeterred, you are all in, you're running for governor.
Well, I'm running for governor for the state of New York. And as I was saying, the $30 billion that I was just talking about, that I had to reduce from deficit of the state of New York, is more than if you took all five of the state's highest annual deficits and added them all together. I've also had to cut spending by a record amount this year. I've been opposed by the special interest, who I've come under a hail of criticism from them for making these tough decisions, and that is what accounts for the low poll numbers. But I wasn't making decisions based on polls.
All right, well, I want to come back to some of the tough choices you're going to make.
I was making decisions based on what I thought was right for the people of New York. So I put the people of New York first when I balanced two budgets in a recession.
All right, but let me ask you about that, Governor.
And I put New York first when I called for a state spending cap.
You said the following on Wednesday, talking about how you would think about the future. You said, "I think if I got to a point where I thought my candidacy was hurting my party, obviously, it would be rather self-absorbed to go forward." You went on to say, "I'm going to keep doing it in terms of running for governor until the public tells me it's time to stop." Governor, your approval ratings, 80% of New Yorkers disapprove of the job you're doing. Aren't you a drag on your party?
I don't think that I am a drag on my party. I think I'm standing up for my party's priorities. I think that you fight for the people of your state. That's what I thought being a Democrat was supposed to be about. Let me tell you, David, poll numbers, I heard that everyone, I appointed a lieutenant governor, and I heard everyone said that the courts would not uphold my appointment. This week, the Court of Appeals of New York upheld my appointment of Lieutenant Governor Richard Ravitch. I have spent a whole life being told I couldn't do things. I was told by guidance counselors I shouldn't go to college. I was told when I was a minority leader of the Senate that we couldn't win the majority. We won 8 seats in 4 years and won the majority. And so I think that what the court upholding my appointment of Lieutenant Governor's message to me this week was that you don't give up. You don't give up because you have low poll numbers. You don't give up because everybody's telling you what the future is. If everyone knew what the future was, why didn't they tell me I was going to become governor? I could have used the heads up.
The opposition, you talked about race being a factor, racism being a factor against you in some of this opposition, and that, in fact, President Obama would be subject to the same thing. Is it still how you feel?
I think when you hear that quote, you're not hearing everything I said. I was responding to news accounts of a story involving my daughter. I thought that the story was not only written to attack me personally and criticize my family, but that it also was entirely stereotypical. What I was trying to say is that I don't think someone's race should be the factor in assessing what kind of governor they are, what kind of president they are, or what kind of worker they are in any workplace. Rightly or wrongly, I thought that that was a double standard in that coverage, but just in case it got lost in the interview, let me clarify that I don't think race has been a factor in my poll numbers, my political fortunes, or how I govern the state. What I think is that we should assess all governors, no matter what color they are, by how they run their states and how they help the people that they work for.
Quickly, Governor, you talked about it before, the mood that you're facing in New York, and indeed the mood around the country has to do with the economy and state finances. If you're all in, if you're running for governor, how are you going to balance New York's budget?
Well, our budget is balanced. We have had...
You face a deficit, potential deficit of $3 billion.
Well, we had a deficit last year. I gave a televised address to the state. I warned New York and America that this would be the worst recession since the Great Depression. I brought the legislature back and balanced the budget last year. We balanced the budget earlier this year, and we have continued to balance our budgets. Let me tell you, David, what has happened is that other states have had difficulties. 21 states have shut down early childhood education and pre-kindergarten programs. 25 states have laid off or furloughed workers. Some states have even had to release prisoners early to save money. The difference is, in New York, we have not had to do that because we knew about this crisis early. Okay. We brought, we acted quickly to avoid disaster. And even while we're cutting $30 billion in 18 months, we've continued to invest in education. We've expanded COBRA benefits for people who've lost their jobs. And we have increased unemployment insurance from 26 weeks to 59 weeks.
All right, Governor, we will have to leave it there. Good luck in your campaign.
What do you think? Is that, do you have a problem with Governor Patterson's position? Now, is this destroying, if this is true, and I believe it is, that the White House, with President Obama's direct knowledge or indirect knowledge, or indirect approval, is saying that Governor David Patterson, a black governor, not very popular, may hurt the chances of the Democratic Party in New York State. Is, if that's true, that President Obama is trying to dissuade him or unencourage him from running, does that destroy the principle of yes, we can? Rod from California says, first of all, brother president is a political animal. He's pragmatic to a fault. And he sees beyond Governor Patterson's race, paying further attention to the bigger picture that apparently doesn't include the governor's stake in the progressive movement from the state of New York. I'm thinking Obama's hoping that Duval Patrick will be ready to step in when the president's terms are over. Notice that the S is in quotes and apostrophe and parentheses. I'm sure you can surmise that this means there might not be more than one term for the good brother president. So Rob from California, he sees this as good political chess. Perhaps President Obama is pragmatic to a fault. I released the remarks of my presentation at George Mason University where I explained, I interpreted President Obama. To me, he's a cultural entrepreneur. He's a diasporic persona. And he's the American emperor all at once. Hell of a mix to balance. That's at CedricMuhammad.com if you want to comment, read that. I agree with what a lot of what Rod said. If anyone in New York has a native opinion, I would love to hear it. Now, I wanted to throw this in quite early. Michael Vick, 7 yards. Total offense, is that correct? No passes complete. I'm starting to wonder if Michael Vick will be gone next year. But just on a man-to-man level, here's Michael Vick's conversation with Sterling Sharp. I want to throw this in the mix. If some of you may not have seen this. This was on NFL TV. And again, God bless the person who came up with NFL Red Zone. which allowed me to watch every touchdown from every single game on Sunday. Here's Michael Vick, Sterling Sharp. This is a man talking, by the way.
You ready, man?
I'm ready.
What are you ready to do?
I'm ready to go out and do what I'm asked to do right now. And my packages, and you know, if I have the opportunity to go out and play quarterback, then I feel like I can do it.
When you look back at your life the last few years, was there a scenario that you looked at it and say, well, this could be said team and me doing this?
You know, I always wanted to look at it from a positive perspective. Always, you know, try to stay optimistic, but I really didn't know, you know, what was going to happen. I knew that, you know, I wasn't forthright with the commissioner, and I knew that, you know, it was a chance that he may not let me back in until he was ready. So I tried to, you know, just, you know, believe that it was going to happen. You know, I wanted the scenario to play out of my head that I was going to come back and, you know, maybe start for a team, but that wasn't the way it played out. But, you know, more the reason that, you know, I'm happy, you know, and thankful that I got an opportunity.
So now the Philadelphia Eagles say, we're going to give you the opportunity to come back.
Yeah.
What was that like?
That was special. At first, I didn't believe when my agent called me and told me.
Thought it was Wait, you always wanted this chance.
Thought it was a hoax, man. You know, I just thought, you know, why the Philadelphia Eagles? You know, why would they want to bring me in? You know, what could I do for them? So I'm playing all these different scenarios in my head. And, you know, I thought about it, and, you know, he called back, and he said they were serious. And I said, hey, okay, let's go. Well, this would be an opportunity for me to, you know, sit back and maybe, you know, learn as much as I can from D. And hey, man, it wasn't the ideal situation.
Donovan McNabb is the guy.
He's the guy.
Donovan McNabb for 10, 11 years has been the guy in Philly. I'm going to Philly to do what?
You know, I missed, you know, all of OTAs, you know, all mm-hmm. of the mini camps. I missed most of the preseason training camp. So it was like, you know, where could I go and be the guy? And do I want that type of pressure? You know, because, you know, I know everything I did would have been scrutinized to a T. You know, I would have been the focal point of the team, and I think that would have took away from the team. So I didn't want to be, you know, selfish in that regard.
What's it like not being the guy?
This is just a different feel. But, you know, you got to live with it. And, you know, it's the best thing for me right now. I have ambition like I never had before. You know, I get here at 7 in the morning just to work out. I never did that before. Ice and cold tub, you know, go watch film. I never did that before because I wanted, and maybe, I don't know if I can reach the, you know, the playing level that I was at, but I know it's potential. You know, I still feel like I got it.
What do you bring to this team that would allow me as an analyst or me as a fan to say, that was a good move, he can help them win?
Well, just another opportunity to put the ball in the end zone, to pick up a first down and pick up 4 or 5 yards when we need it. I think it's just beneficial just to have me around, you know, even if it's as a decoy. You know, I can...
Michael Vick, a decoy. Michael Vick, a
decoy. I got to do what I got to do right
Michael
now.
Michael Vick, a decoy. Help me here if I'm interpreting this wrong, is that if I would have said that 4 or 5 years ago...
I'd have been like, man, you're right.
The opportunity to just be there on the field, on the sideline, a chance to play. That's enough for you right now.
That's enough for me, because I didn't have that 2 years ago. You know, in the last 2 years, I've been watching football from afar.
When you saw Ronnie Brown unleash the Wildcat on the New England Patriots, first thought that came to you?
I stood up and told everybody, look, hey, I was the originator of that.
You said that?
I told him. Watching him do that, you know, brought back so many memories. And, you know, it was hard to, you know, watch the highlights because, you know, I was like, man, I remember running that play against such and such. You know, we got this amount of yards, and I vividly remember everything. And it was just, it was hard, man.
Could the 2 years you missed be a blessing in disguise?
It was definitely a blessing. I would have never changed.
That's the line right there. Michael Vick saying he never would have changed without prison and the time off. I want to get into this a little later on Brick City. This is really a definition of quote-unquote repentance. Till you hate something, you will not change. You will not completely turn away from it.
I wouldn't have ever changed as an individual off the field. I wouldn't ever change as a player. You know, in the film room and just being, you know, one of the guys in the locker room. Y'all under me, so when it's over, if I ain't in the front, at least I'm gonna be.
Cedric Muhammad.